What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Hi guys, welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Thanks so much for listening. You're definitely going to want to subscribe to our Patreon, and you can do that at patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show so that you can hear the rest of this interview, because we have some really great nuggets that come that you get to hear when you become a Patreon subscriber. And also you should consider giving Patreon memberships as holiday gifts. It's a cool gift. Okay, thanks, bye. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper. Please like us, rate us, review us on iTunes, follow us on SoundCloud. It's a great time. I'm here as usual with my co-host, Gabe Pacheco.
Hello, everybody. Just wanted to say thank you to everyone who has already donated to the Patreon.
Yes.
We really couldn't do this without you guys, and it really means a lot. It means that I don't feel like I'm shouting into the void anymore.
Right.
And every little bit helps keep us on the air. And you know, we're not making a lot of money off this. We're not getting rich, but
no, it all goes into
the production value, the time, attention, and effort that we can put into creating a product for all of you people out there that just need to hear our voices.
Yes.
In your head while you're walking around.
I'm not sure why it makes Gabe feel like he's not talking into a void, but it's definitely, you mean, because it's nice to know that people listen and that the support.
It's the only way I feel love.
Right, I get it. Through money.
Yes.
By my love and affection. And we want to thank people for coming to our live show, which was great. We had a live show.
It was packed wall to wall.
It was packed. And we do that, and we had karaoke, and we're going to be doing these every second Wednesday of the month at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic. And next month, we're going to have Abby Martin from Telesur, she used to be there, the journalist. And we have this cool deal with Credo. Remember, Credo is a great company, so we're very happy. You guys know Credo guests in the past. They're notoriously, literally, table pounding. You got Becky Bond, pounds a table. You got Murshid Zahid, pounds a table.
They all laugh into the mic, though.
Those
are our friends that laugh into the
exactly.
mic.
Exactly, yeah. Becky really does, yeah. And Becky, of course, went on from Credo to be a senior Bernie organizer.
Yeah. I'm here, still alive, barely.
Terrible
cold, Katie.
Terrible cold, yeah.
But you know what?
What?
Today I was walking on 110th Street, and I saw a guy, and he had a box of the orange Dayquils, and he was just selling Dayquil Lucy's for a dollar right outside of the 6 train. And I copped a couple of those, and so I'm feeling all right.
Wow. Were they wrapped?
They were still wrapped.
Okay,
I'm not gonna buy unwrapped pills.
I know. I mean, I was just checking.
But
didn't know how desperate you were.
No, man.
We have a great show for you today. It's gonna come full circle. You'll see what I mean in a second. But I knew that Gabe was sick because I saw him this weekend, because we both saw a one-woman show, and we are gonna be having the star and creator of that one-woman show on our show today. Layla Ben Abdallah is going to be talking to us about her latest one-woman show called Good Morning Zetunia. We also have Susie Weissman and Robert Brenner talking to us later in the show. We're very excited. So,
yeah.
But back to your health stuff. So when I saw you in the theater, oh my gosh, I saw you at the Pitt Theater.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Oh, I was swaddled. The only part of my body that was exposed was my face, and it was just dripping sweat, but I was still chilled, still freezing.
Perfect combo.
Shivering.
Yeah.
Yes. So sweaty and shivering at the same time.
It was like your face was gray.
Yeah, I look like John Cusack in the lovemaking scene in Say Anything. I don't know if you've seen that movie.
I have
but
seen it, but I don't remember the skin.
He's in a car with Ione Skye, right. And they're both hugging, spooning, postcoitally, and he is both shivering, and he's covered in a sweaty sheen.
Got it.
And so that was exactly how I felt, only without the fun of having a postcoital session right. with Ione Skye, just me by myself. Feverish
right.
and delirious. But, you know, I'm committed. I'm a professional, and I needed to go see this show, so
exactly.
I went.
Exactly.
I forced myself to go. I powered through. And Uber there and back. I don't usually take Ubers, but this was like a special occasion.
Yeah, it was a special Uber occasion.
You know what, though, Katie? What? I spent the rest of the last couple days inside. All I've been doing is binging on Netflix, and I saw a movie. I saw Allende.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's basically the film is a dramatization of the last 7 hours of his Ooh. Life.
Those are action-packed. Let's be honest. Those are going to be action-packed hours.
It was pretty interesting. I mean, I really recommend it to anybody that wants to see how regimes end.
Right.
And the anecdote I wanted to bring up from it was how hopeful he was. Even at the end, his assistants.
Can I just explain what people so people in case
yeah,
people don't
please.
Know? So Allende was the democratically elected president of Chile, and he was overthrown in 1973 on September 11th in a coup that was supported. You know, on the down low, is it the down low or the low down? Which one is it?
It was
on the down low. On the down low by the United States and by the CIA.
By Nixon specifically
Kissinger. He said, there's no need to let a country go communist just because they're irrational or something like that.
Well, he wanted to nationalize, Allende wanted to nationalize the copper mines. And that was a big deal for our companies in the U.S.
Exactly.
And they hated that idea.
They hated that. So they want to make the economy scream. But I just want to make sure people know who this is. Augusto Pinochet took over in a violent coup, and it was a horrible human rights violating dictatorship that lasted until the 90s and like really cutting edge sexual torture stuff. Like, and so now that people know,
this film just follows his last 7 hours. And this is my favorite type of film, which is like the end of the siege, sort of in the bunker moments of a leader. And he's in denial optimistically up until the end. He wakes up and he finds out that the Navy has defected. And then he finds out that the Air Force has defected. And he's like, okay, well, I've still got the Army. And then finally, he finds out that from one of his administrators that Pinochet with the Army has also turned his back on him. So now he's all alone. And Allende goes, well, that's all right. The people will rise up and defend me. And the thing was, is that as opposed to Fidel, he was into a nonviolent revolution. And he goes, the people will defend me with their weapons. And then his assistant says, oh, don't you remember we took their guns away earlier? And so there, this is...
Gabe is not actually a Pinochet fan with no sympathy for Allende. He's just, from the dramatic angle
the irony that he's like, oh, yeah.
Right.
Gun control is the reason that the people could not rise up and help me out. So
his last, although in all fairness, they may not have been able to anyway, because it was an army back coup.
Right.
His last speech that he broadcast from the, what is it called? The the palace?
Moneda.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was so moving and sad. It's like a farewell speech. And then he killed himself, they say. There's some controversy over whether he killed himself or he was killed, but they were going to take him and kill him.
Absolutely.
They pretended that they were going to like let him leave and not kill him, but they were recording.
They were going to let him get on a plane, and then that plane was going to mysteriously crash.
Or he'd be dropped into the sea, which is what they did with a lot of people. They would drug them and then drop them into the sea. Yeah, and that's another reason, by the way, that Fidel Castro, I mean, Che Guevara was in Guatemala when there was another CIA-backed coup against a democratic, non-violent, unarmed, you know, democratically elected left reformist, not a revolutionary, Arbenz. And that is something, one of the things that influenced Che to be like, oh yeah, maybe we do have to do this whole armed revolution thing. And then the thing in Chile was another thing. They were like, yeah, you see what happens when you don't have a very armed...
Yeah, you gotta... So, you know, you've got to have at least the threat of violence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, whatever. I mean, we have... All right. Let's look at the death penalty here. Hello. Okay, that was great. But we are really excited. We're going to call our first guest. Layla Ben Abdullah is an actor and comedian with the People's Improv Theater in New York, and she's also the writer of a new show called Good Morning Zetunia, in which she performs with puppets to act out a satirical version of the events of the Arab Spring in the fictional... nation of Zetunia, Using puppetry sketch and character pieces, Layla tells the story of a dictator-controlled morning news show on the last day of broadcast.
This is Good Morning Zetunia, the most trusted and only news source in the Republic of Zetunia. Truthful, objective, fair, and subject to the regulations of the Zetunian State Secrecy Bureau and our glorious and beloved President of the Republic, President Boussalim.
Good morning, Zetunia. Good morning, Zetunia. Good morning, Zetunia.
Viewing is mandatory, subject to arrest and incarceration of you and your entire family.
Hello.
Hi, Layla.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, you?
Good.
Layla, congratulations on your show, Good Morning Zetunia, which I saw this weekend. It's great. Can you tell people how they can see it?
I have two performances left. They're both Fridays. The first one is this Friday, December 23rd at 7:30 at the Pit Loft, 154 West 29th Street. It's at 7:30. And the second performance is Friday the 30th, also at 7:30.
So can you tell us about how you created this one-woman show, what inspired you to do it, and how it relates to your own personal background?
Yeah, so I've done several solo shows before this, so that's sort of a medium that I feel very comfortable in. And I knew I wanted to talk about the Arab Spring and whatever solo show I did next, because I'm half Tunisian. My father's from Tunisia. And for anyone who sort of knows the Arab Spring, we were I was in the States. I was not like on the ground in Tunisia,
but you were there.
We started the Arab Spring. I was there in spirit,
yeah.
Obsessively on social media for the months that it was going on, but we were the ones that catalyzed that. And it was sort of looking around at the world now and realizing that I think more people having more understanding about the Arab Spring and what came before and how it unfolded and how the world has been affected by it afterwards would really just go such a long way in helping a lot of people understand what's happening now, especially Americans. So I wanted to sort of see something fall apart and play that sort of frenetic, like everything's fine. But meanwhile, like everything is on fire out in the street. The news station, because it felt like that would allow me to do that in a really fun way. Just like watch them all panic to try to maintain this veneer of calm. But it's far from that.
Yeah, it also it reminded me of election night as well, at least for everyone who was part of the established Democrat press corps, sort of the unnerving, the dissonance that between what was happening on the ground and what we were led to believe by everyone in suits on television.
Exactly. And then this feeling like when the dust all settled of everyone just being like, how did this happen? And then really looking at it and realizing it's been in front of us the whole time that something like this would happen.
Right. What do you see as the connection between the Arab Spring and what we experience here?
Well, I think that something that we saw in the Arab Spring was just that a lot of these stories of people that were feeling this disillusionment were, it was like happening behind closed doors or being, you know, forcibly oppressed in some way or just buried in general. And when it finally happened, the Arab Spring, there was this feeling of like, oh my gosh, where did this all come from? Where did this anger come from? Mm. And because over there, it's, you know, I certainly heighten my show to comedic effect, but that all is true in the sense of this widespread propaganda. And while we certainly don't have that same level of propaganda here, there was this feeling when it happened that there was just this huge swath of the country with concerns that we were just not aware of. And then even in the way that I see, like the media in Tunisia sort of trying to say that, you know, that these sorts of things, like the protests and the violence in the street was being carried out by like a small faction of people that were, you know, extremists and being very violent and purposely trying to generate chaos, when in reality, they were just people that were feeling hopeless and feeling, you know, either deeply impoverished or just a lack of opportunities, if not poverty of that level. And I think we kind of are confronting a little bit of that now, just this feeling of like, I didn't know that these people felt this way.
Right. Yeah. Although it's interesting because here it's kind of like, I didn't know that these people were awful, racist, sexist, homophobes. They're not even like allowing that acknowledgement. You know what I mean? People who are still invested in the narrative of the election in the United States and Trump's victory, you know, who frame Trump's victory as the kind of moral abdication of a group of bigots. And of course, it's not like there aren't bigots among Trump supporters, but I do think that what's fascinating is, and really scary, is that these same people who were convinced that Hillary Clinton would win and got it wrong, obviously, are now telling us that we should listen to them now because they're getting it right now. It's like, well, were you wrong then and now you're right? Why should we trust your takeaway? Especially because they're blaming everyone but themselves.
And I it's interesting that I think that it's easier for us to be objective about people far away. Like right now, when you're saying that in Tunisia that the Arab Spring was people who were dissatisfied, we're not calling them all homophobes or racists or bigots because they were going for that revolt against the status quo. But here we're saying that. I'm not defending Trump, by the way, any way, shape, or form.
Gabe has a Trump t-shirt on. You don't know that with a heart on it. No.
But the idea of a general dissatisfaction with the status quo is what leads to any rebellion.
Right.
And
well, you know what they do though, is they I feel like the parallel there would be the casting of all rebels as Islamists, Muslim fundamentalists, right? So we saw that.
Right.
That's one of the things that they do, right? So they
right, exactly.
Yeah. You know what I mean, Gabe?
Yeah, whereas like here, you know, our sort of,
yes,
you know, we call them, you know, bigots and racists,
right.
And over there the sort of version of that was extremists.
Yeah, Muslim extremists, fundamentalists. And of course, it all relates in that, you know, there are two issues, and we've talked about this a lot on the show. One issue is kind of a moral judgment about people and what you think of them. But the other stuff is just like, I mean, even if you hate these people, you need to figure out how to not make them really angry. That's what shocks me about, at least in the United States, the lack of kind of strategic thinking around it. And there's so much entitlement. And yeah, it's funny. When I was watching, I didn't think of it this much. But now that we're talking about it, I mean, this is the Katie Halper Show where literally everything is dragged into the Bernie Clinton zone. But it's not unrelated. It's fascinating.
I was wondering what the one thing that I didn't 100% get from your show, and maybe you left this ambiguity out there for all of us, but what was the political bent of the Arab Spring in Tunisia?
I mean, it's hard to say exactly what, because it was just in general, not so much that there's one particular political bent, so much as we want to be able to engage in politics in general. You know, because when under dictatorship, it's like, you know, there are these sort of sham elections that happen every couple of years, and it's one party on the ballot that you literally can bubble in one little circle or not do it at all.
Right. That's choice.
They have one bubble and, scantron.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
what's
pretty
it gonna
much.
Be?
Yeah, exactly. And and all other political discourse is, you know, they're either sent into exile or forcibly disappeared is a very interesting tactic that dictators like to employ.
Right.
And
give credit to Chile.
Just desire to, what's that?
We got to give a lot of credit to Latin America on that one. We were talking about Chile before, so sorry. Just wanted to give them big ups for the disappearances. Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off.
Exactly. No, not at all. Yeah, so it wasn't so much that there was this revolution in place for like to bring into power one particular ideology, just so much as just a ability to engage in it at all. And after the revolution, when we had our first free and fair elections, as an independent monitor called them, it was actually a somewhat secular, but it was an Islamist party that won, and by popular vote. And a couple of years later, when we had our second election, then it was a non-Islamist party that won, and they just totally peacefully ceded power and said, you know, thanks for the chance to rule you like the way that we do it here, and took off and let the next group come in.
This is how we do it.
Yeah,
it's Friday night.
That first peaceful
Islamist.
For the first peaceful transition, man, that's a big step. That's a big step for any
it
fledgling
was,
democracy.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. And it all does go back to that balance of power, right? If you crush rebellions or crush people too much, they just, it's not a good look.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and I have a question. Did you feel at all conflicted given that that the kind of Islamophobia and Arab phobia, and of course those two things are not the same thing, but most people who have one don't know that anyway. But do you feel at all conflicted about the way you represent Tunisia or the Arab world? Like, do you feel do you feel any conflict about it? Like, you want to make sure that the stereotypes are not perpetuated?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, for me, doing this show and giving an opportunity and, like, giving an opportunity to just share a little bit of context of why this revolution happened and what was happening before, I think for me it does, at least I hope, it does a lot in terms of breaking down stereotypes. Because I think the big stereotype is that the Arab and Muslim world, or the Arab world and the Muslim world, are just sort of these inherently violent, generally messed up places, mm-hmm. just full of people whose ideology is so crazy that there's no way those of us in the States could ever relate to it. And I think that a lot of people definitely feel that way about, you know, places like Syria. They're just like, oh, well, it's obviously just sort of descended into this sectarian craziness. When you actually understand, like, what precipitated something like that, which was this, you know, live or die feeling of, you know, we want freedom, we want democracy, these things that here in the States we sort of think of as being very unique to us, when it's not at all. Because when you look at the rest of the world and you see who's fighting and dying for it, it's Muslims. So for me, I just wanted with this show to talk a little bit about, like, what was going on in these places before this revolution and spread some understanding of why it happened to begin with. Because I don't think anybody would listen to that and say, oh, you know, that you have a president who's been in power for 30 years who just appoints all of his cronies and family members to all these positions and enriches himself and his family and violently crushes dissent and, you know, and wouldn't fight and in some cases give their lives against that. You know, I don't think anybody would feel that way.
Mm. Have you received any negative attention for the work that you put out there?
You know, it's so funny. I don't receive negative attention for my work, but every now and then I just get some sort of, like, random non sequitur tweet that's just like, hey, why aren't you wearing a hijab? And I'm like, where are you coming from? And what does that have to do with anything? I mean, I have in my Twitter bio that I'm Tunisian American, but that's just because I have, like, you know, I try to, like, network with Tunisian filmmakers and whatnot. I want them to know that I'm, like, legit or whatever.
Yeah.
But every now and then I'll just get some kind of, like, random stuff like that. I think just by nature of having a distinctly Muslim name. But in terms of my work, you know,
Well, now you got the Katie Halper Show bump. Hopefully you'll get a lot of, you know.
You'll get tens of new fans.
New haters.
But one thing I wanted to say was that I loved the show because I like history and I like, you know, political science, and I love Sesame Street.
Mm.
So I think if people, the intersection of
intersectionality, puppets, yeah, exactly.
Of puppets and geopolitics, make this a win for me.
Yeah, no one else touches intersectionality when it comes to puppets. You know, that's the last frontier. So we're finally doing that.
Do you have any final takeaways for what you'd like maybe an audience to get from your show?
And also remind us where people can see it too.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wrote the show to be a story about the Arab Spring and not meant to be any kind of allegory for American politics. But I think we're in a place right now where just kind of letting go of this idea that things that happen in the Arab world are so foreign and so different from what could happen here would really give us a really great opportunity to understand how exactly dictatorship can take hold and flourish. So I think really understanding this, like, extremely recent part of history will help us see where parallels are being drawn between our situation and help us understand how we can resist.
Right. Yeah. Resistance. That is the theme. Well, thank you so much, Layla. And people, check out her show at the Pit Loft. Remember, make sure you go to that one because there are a couple of Pit locations. And that's West 29th?
That's right.
Yes. This is the Pit Loft on West 29th.
Yeah. You got two more chances. You only have two chances. Do not stand. This is, this opportunity comes twice in a lifetime until it's renewed. That's my little Eminem shout out. Thank you so much, Layla, and come back. We'll have you on for longer next time.
Thank you. I love that. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks.
Okay, bye, Layla.
Bye.
Bye.
That was a good time. Huh?
So much fun. I love hearing about government disintegrations.
I know. Gabe is, like, smiling ear to ear. He's got his Trump t-shirt on. Just kidding.
Can we do puppet videos?
Yeah, we should. Let's do every show. We should have a puppet.
Just like two or 3 minute, like a moment in socialist history.
Oh, yeah, that would be
cute.
Like
a Eugene V. Debs puppet.
Oh, my God, that'd be really cute.
Just getting put in jail by Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, that would be really cute.
He'll be like, Alien Sedition Act, and then there it is.
I can't believe last week I saw Bernie Sanders speak at Cooper reunion.
What?
And he was asked what his favorite books were because it was an event put on by the Strand, the bookstore.
I know the place.
And, well, I want to be inclusive to our non-New York audience. And yeah. He said biographies. Come on, guys. He mentioned that biographies were his favorite books.
Oh, yeah?
And he said Eugene V. Debs biography and Martin Luther King biography. And the reason he liked the Martin Luther King stuff is because basically, you know, everyone presents Martin Luther King as like just a civil rights person who with a kind of narrow focus.
But he knew how to play pool, according to some photos of him.
Well, there's that. There's the untold pool playing story. But also there's the untold or less told or whitewashed, no pun intended, or perhaps it is. You see what happens? I start talking about it and then we get feedback because the man doesn't want us to go there. He was anti-capitalist, and he talked about capitalism, and he talked about the poor people's march. He was great, by the way, when I saw him. And he also said, you know, remember that he says a couple of great things, and one of them was that Donald Trump doesn't have a mandate because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote
by 2.5 million people.
I want everybody here not to forget ever that in terms of the popular vote, Mr. Trump lost that to Secretary Clinton by almost 3 million votes. Mr. Trump does not have a mandate to carry out his extremist ideas. And we should not forget that.
Which is funny because then you get people on Twitter who are just like, he never said that. Why didn't Bernie say that? It's like, you're just an actual liar. The other thing that he said, this was cute. He's like, the good stuff is you're not out there on the margins. You're not on the vanguard at the margins fighting for, you know, like radical extremist things. You know, these are things that that people want, progressive, enormously popular things, which was a nice comforting feeling.
I want all of you to know that you're not heroes and heroines fighting some great uphill struggle out on the vanguard. What your views are, by and large, represent where the American people are on issue after issue. Should we raise the minimum wage to a living wage? Overwhelming support. Pay equity for women. Overwhelming support among parts of the American people. Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, progressives. What I'm saying is that on all of those issues, that is where the American people are.
Welcome. This is, we take down the fourth wall on this show. So we have two guests who just walked into the room. We are really excited to bring in our next guests. We have Susie Weissman and Robert Brenner. And Robert Brenner is the director of the UCLA Center for Social Theory and Comparative History. And Susie Weissman is the host of Beneath the Surface, which is a Pacifica show, and KPFK. And also the author of Victor Serge, A Political Biography. Susie's also an award-winning broadcast journalist and professor of politics at St. Mary's College. I like to call them one of the power couples of the left.
The Jay-Z and Beyonce of the left?
Totally.
Well, that's
he didn't like that.
Pretty good, I guess.
Yeah.
We'll take it.
Okay, good. Well, thank you guys so much for coming.
Great to be here.
Yeah, really exciting to have you. Is everyone's volume good?
Nah.
She needs more volume. Oh, I just want. Oh, that's yours. Good. That's my knob. Oh, Gabe, that's very forward of you. That's my knob. Sorry, couldn't help it. Susie, you can. Oh, good. Susie did laugh into the mic.
There we go.
Do you? Perfect. Okay, you got it. Now that's Susie's knob.
Okay, great. Sorry. I hope.
I hope
no one else in this room minds.
Yeah. Bob, you guys are you're a modern couple.
You can at my mic anytime.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh,
thank you, Susie.
Susie's very good.
Yeah.
Brought her A game. So, yeah, really, thank you guys so much. And you are at the new school this semester, correct? Let's talk a little bit about what is happening right now with this like really cool revival of McCarthyism, if you will.
New McCarthyism. Well, there is a professor's watch list out there that's an update from David Horowitz's earlier one. Somehow they forgot to put me on it and I feel slighted.
I'm going to write a letter to the editor about
that. Well, no, but what we did and what most universities are doing, lots of them, including mine, are en masse asking to join it. To join the list of those who should be watched.
It's an
act of solidarity and also diluting it. Then the question becomes really, is this a kind of new McCarthyism? And there, like so much, we really don't yet know.
Right. And also the way that the the Russians are coming is being applied to the election and the language that's used around it. And I listened to your show and you had a really great guest on.
Arch Getty.
And he was saying really fascinating things about this.
I don't think that we should lose sight of the fact that this is really about the leaking or the exposure of the Democratic National Committee emails that were damning in themselves. And in order to deflect attention from the content of those mails, they pointed the fingers at the Russians. They had no evidence. And now it's just taken on a life of its own. And it's all part of what was going on prior to that, when Hillary Clinton was upping the ante against Russia, not pushing reset in the way of resetting the relations, but maybe backset to Cold War politics. And then that raised the questions, well, what was that really about? But just on the question of the hacking or leaking, whichever it may turn out to be, we're asked to believe this without a shred of evidence. The only evidence is the say-so, first of all, of the political class and the CIA and the echoing of it by all of the media. And it's got that effect that after being repeated so many times, people are just taking it as truth.
Goebbels was right.
Yeah.
Right?
But there's no evidence presented yet. And that long article that appeared in the New York Times about a week ago did not present any facts. In fact, it's been called fact-free.
And fanciful.
Yeah. So the question is, you know, if you know anything about Russia, you know, they would not be so clumsy to do it the way that it's been portrayed to have been done. They wouldn't use, like, the code name Felix Dzerzhinsky, the first head of the Secret Service or the Cheka at the time. They would not use Cozy Bear or Cyrillic typewriter. And the other side of it is, of course, anybody who knows anything about Russia today is that hacking is a sport and everybody does it. You'll go on the street, anybody you talk to will, you know, ask you questions about what may or may not have been hacked.
Right.
So the thought that you could just say that these hacks came from the highest sources, you'd have to ask why and present some evidence.
There's a great CNN story that was just out on December 15th, but the headline was Intel Analysis Shows Putin Approved Election Hacking. And that's the headline. And then in the second paragraph, it says, but neither of the sources said they knew of specific intelligence that directly ties Putin to the attack. That's just an example of the blatant kind of, you know, disconnect between what the headline says and what the actual facts are.
Inside Russia today, the story is the rigging of their own sort of, you know, regional elections. And so he's much more concerned about what's going on domestically.
Right.
Yeah. I also find it interesting that it's the Democratic Party that I always thought of as more dovish or at least more open and left-leaning to be banging the war drum right now, calling making us all scared of Russia again. And that somehow the Republicans that are the hawkish
right.
nationalists are kind of like, all right, yeah, I like Putin.
Now they're peacenik internationalists.
Nixon that did detente.
Yeah.
So, right. Not that that really shows or means anything, but usually the Democrats are less comfortable in power, and if they're going to put forward social programs, they have to first show their anti-communist credentials. Where, how that fits today, anyone's
right.
guess.
Right.
It's like a Democrat politician needs to be like, show that they're like a hawk or tough on crime or whatever.
Right. Or the other. Exactly. Yeah. Or it takes, as
Thomas Frank.
Yes. Thomas Frank says in his book, he quotes someone who says it takes a liberal sometimes. This is the other side of it, right? Like, it takes a liberal to slash spending in a way that won't get the opposition that a Republican will get.
They do the dirty work.
Exactly. But I wanted to talk about the election. And Bob, you are someone who focuses on the economy. And I think that these things are related, obviously, right? You see, I think, this blaming the Russia, the Russians are coming. My dad was joking that the evidence is that there was like borscht on the hacked. She covered her mouth. Don't cover the mouth. On the hacked documents or something. And of course, as your guest was saying, if they were sophisticated hackers, they wouldn't have the, you know, it wouldn't be in Cyrillic font and it wouldn't have like a famous secret policeman's name on it. I was just waiting for it to be like, hi, like I wanted the username to be like, Vladimir Putin did this, and the password being like, no, really, I did it. Like, not even joking, in Russian. But I think that speaks to this denial or kind of obfuscation of what happened. So as if Hillary Clinton and the Democrats can just talk about how the Russians did this, they don't have to talk about the economics or the sociological forces around why Trump came to power. So could you talk about what you think played a role into his victory?
Sure. I mean, I think you're on target so far in that the Clinton response to the defeat with the pushing forward of this Putin intervention and so on was a continuation of the absolute bankruptcy of that campaign and the Democratic Party today. I mean, you have, I mean, everybody's, I think, pretty well aware of this, that the Clinton campaign was completely incapable of speaking to the, you know, populist issues that its own staff knew were absolutely central. I mean, its own staff knew that on the one hand you have Sanders, on the other hand you have Trump, and that the way forward at this point, I mean, you don't need to have big economics. You just look back since 1972. There's been a decline in real wages for the 80%, 90% of the American working class. Decline since that period. So you have like a half century with people unable to get a raise. So it, you know, we could, you know, go into millions of more statistics, but this is, you know, very clear that this is the centerpiece of the, you know, the background to the election. You have essentially an inability of Hillary to speak to these issues. She was disqualified from speaking to these issues by her connections with Wall Street, by her support for trade, by her anti-union policy. Every aspect of her politics disqualified her from speaking to the fundamental issues that Sanders, you know, made that great run on and that Trump saw an opening for. Right. So basically what her advisors, I think, saw was that if she ran as Hillary Clinton, she would be slaughtered. As it was, she ran as something fairly close to Hillary Clinton, trying to get the support of the suburban women, the, you know, basically the new constituency of the Democratic Party, not so new, but for 30 years or so, it's been ever high, you know, looking ever higher on the socioeconomic scale to get their support, looking to those people. And so she had herself in an incredible bind. And only in that way could Trump have won. I mean, Trump barely got more votes than the Republicans got in 2012. And what it really mainly took was Hillary being unable to get, you know, do anywhere near as well as Obama had, which was not that great in 2012. If you look at the shifts that won the election for Trump, it was about a million votes. And in the, I'm talking about the, you know, the contested states, Michigan's own. So about a million votes in all, and 80% of them were votes that Hillary didn't get, that Obama got. Trump barely got, you know, maybe 20% of these votes, which, you know, were more than his predecessors. So
it wasn't that he did so well, it's that she did pretty badly.
She did very, very badly. And for me, she totally deserved what she got, and the fact that neoliberalism was dealt a powerful defeat should be an inspiration to us, and rather than a source of depression. And you know, I would say that's where politics should begin for the left.
Right. Although I remember, to pull back the curtain a little bit, I was actually with you guys on election night, and I remember you said, Susie, you said it's going to be a Brexit. It's Bob. It's going to be a Brexit. And you were right, of course. But I also remember when another time we were talking, and we were kind of like, well, of course, we got to get Clinton in there. Like Adolf Reed, you know, had this piece, Vote for the Neoliberal Warmonger, right? And but I think what's happening is that what you just said, I mean, there is a potential opening, right? And I think there's this weird self-censorship, because when you say there's an opening, you're not dismissing all the terrible stuff that will and can happen. But I really think that there's such a liberal policing of discourse that we can't, like, if you even say that, it's white privilege. And this is a whole other thing that we could get into. But the idea that, you know, to see anything potentially positive about this is somehow like co-signing or sanctioning the racism of the Trump agenda. Of course, I would argue that if we want to defeat the Trump agenda, we actually have to look at how to organize against it, right? And where those openings are. So what do you guys think about how to move forward kind of concretely in terms of organizing? And I'm curious if as a couple, are there any issues that you guys disagree on when it comes to this? Like, any fights that you want to share on air?
Katie, well, that's a great... That's you like to break up couples on air.
I do. How's that? Share on air. We did have Liza Featherstone and Doug Henwood on. The slogan for that was the couple that hates neoliberalism together stays together. So
well,
you guys are in good company.
I think that describes us too.
Right.
But if anything, Bob might think that I'm slightly softer. But I think that... Because I really think you have to have an inside-outside game. And more than anything right now... You have to have, and Bob will not disagree with me, I'm sure, there's an opening. The Sanders campaign is really the story of this election and really for this century so far, because it shows that for a wide swath of the population, they, you know, not only rejected the candidate and the party, but that they think socialism is okay, and they reject capitalism as well. So that didn't go away just because Trump won. And Trump jumps into power after having promised a sort of populist New Deal, in the sense infrastructure building and all of these, you know, a better health care plan. And he puts people into power who are absolutely going to do a slash and burn. And that's what we have to face in this next period. So the resistance to it is key. And the question about that resistance is what kind of, you know, what kind of strategic focus it has. And I think that's really the key issue about organizing in this period.
I do think a second look more should be taken, though, to cash out this notion of it opening today. Because what happened on the morrow of the election? Within about 30 seconds, you had Schumer appointed head, majority leader, and you had Nancy Pelosi. So these are, of course, brand new faces designed to speak to the rising massive opposition was taking this populist, initiative. And then, but if you
being sarcastic,
it's much worse. It's much, much worse than that. If you look at every constituency in the Democratic Party, there is none that opened itself up even in the slightest degree to the Sanders forces, especially. You had you look at the Black Congressional Caucus, which is where you might expect some progressive motion. Complete rejection of Sanders.
John Lewis marked him absent from the civil rights movement. That was so embarrassing. As if he took attendance or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And he didn't do a very good job of taking attendance.
Exactly.
Because the guy happened to be
exactly.
there.
Exactly. And there would happen to be photographic and videographic evidence. Oh, well. Hmm. Oops.
You look at, frankly, the union movement. Almost the entirety of the union movement stuck with Clinton. Did not make a peep. You did have an
labor for Bernie, though.
I think that's rare. That's absolutely right.
The nurses, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
you had more than that. Sure. You had about four or five leading unions that did make this break, and that is exceedingly important. But what I think is crucial is the way this Democratic leadership, leadership of the, leading themselves is organized, is really without much give. The way the, sort of politics of neoliberalism is set up today, there is not, like, there's no opening for reform. You would have, of the old, reform, of course, is now taken over by the right, but the basic ideas of some sort of jobs programs or so on.
Increased social welfare.
Increased social welfare.
We're going to see huge cuts.
Right.
Instead.
I mean, look at even when she was running for office, she insisted initially, no, we can't raise the minimum wage past $12. You might. I mean, if I had been running with her politics, I would have lied and said, "Of course, I'm for that." But she clearly thought she was a principled supporter of the neoliberal politics she'd long held, and was so arrogant about you know, the lack of any, you know, alternative that she was able to do. I think that is the first thing for about that people should not have the slightest hope in what constitutes a Democratic Party. Sanders ran as a Democrat, but not of the Democratic Party. And the mobilization that he made was almost entirely new forces outside the party. And that set the example that we should be looking for. On the other hand, I think that the Trump politics also gives us a tremendous opening, because while Trump said the right things, you know, in the election, first in the primaries, and then especially at the start of the election, talking about you know, opposition to free trade, he talked at a moment of cutting the military, and he's always against finance and so on, but he had no organization that expressed that right-wing populism. So when he comes in, what he ends up doing is what the Republican or Democrat did, which was move further to the right compared to the previous administration. And so you have now a very hard right politics that is heavily continuous with what came before. And I don't think that is going to, you know, do very well with this base that elected him, who really saw him as their candidate. Of course, a lot of it is racist. A lot of it is what people say it is. But a lot of it also had some hope that he would open things up a little bit for them. It's going to be just the opposite. So you're going to have, even from Trump, it seems to me, a further right-wing neoliberalism compared to a very far right-wing neoliberalism of the Democratic Party. So there's a massive opening. And the question is going to be, can people take up, in a sense, inside and outside, as Susie said, where Sanders left off? Can Sanders himself, with Elizabeth Warren, will they have the guts basically to say no to all the legislation that's come down the pipe and to break with effectively break politically with the Democratic Party? Sanders, you know, I hope he does. I mean, he seems to have the desire to do that, but to actually say something about, for example, Obama, who had, you know, no different, his politics are no different from Hillary's.
Except less hawkish, I think. But he did appoint her Secretary of State, so he's not that principled on it. But I do think
he is the chief, deporter in chief.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not just that, but I mean, I think that you saw when Obama came in, and there's probably a lot of reasons, if we wanted to do a different show and talk about why he behaved as he did. But what he did was to waste the first year trying to, you know, get along. Mm. And the Republicans, on the other hand, traded in their boxing gloves for brass knuckles. And now we see what comes after brass knuckles. I don't know, knives, you know, because now we see McCrory giving the Republicans the template for what to do from here on in. McCrory, the governor of North Carolina, who first refused to accept the results of the election, had already tried to suppress the vote, and now has basically, you know, changed the rules to strip the governor from power so that it doesn't matter if Democrats come in, even tepid center-right Democrats. So given all of that, the question is, can we see this Democratic Party taking on a fighting role like that? And I can't. And I can't see even Chuck Schumer, you know, who now says he's in favor of Ralph Ellison. But,
Keith Ellison.
Keith Ellison.
Right.
And we don't know what that's going to mean. But literally, I say what I take the opening to mean is that the social movements have to grow to such an extent that the Democrats come to the social movement to ask what to do next. And not the other way, you know, the reverse.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was literally a good, like, journalist, Alec McGillis tweeted, "Gotta wonder whether the fight for 15 could have put more focus on preventing election of someone whose labor secretary is their leading foe." I mean, literally blaming this movement for not doing more for Hillary.
It's always good to blame poor people.
I couldn't believe it. Maybe it was Hillary not doing more for the movement And then Mark Murray, who's this MSNBC guy, tweets, in retrospect, the big Dem/progressive fight over the size of minimum wage, 12 or 15, seems quaint, doesn't it?
Oh,
you like literally their takeaway. I mean, this is how entitled and out of touch they are. It's that they say the things we know that they think, but think that they wouldn't say or write out loud, right? But they do it publicly. So the fault, we're going to blame the Fight for 15 movement. And the takeaway is that Sanders shouldn't have pushed for 15 over 12. Because look what we have now. Don't they get that's the exact opposite? Part of the reason we have Trump is because Clinton was the candidate who on her own hadn't pushed for the $15 minimum wage because she was a $12 minimum wage person. It was like, is this a parody? I mean, that's what I can't. Last night, by the way, and in other parody things, people were tweeting literally like they were writing it out. F you, Bernie Sanders, because of the Electoral College stuff. It was on him. Like, the man ran across the country. He didn't have to endorse her. He didn't have to campaign for her. He did more for her than I think most people did. And they're just literally cursing him like aloud.
Or this sort of, this last gasp hope that somehow the faithless electors would change their votes, as it turned out more of them changed from Hillary than changed from Trump. So, you know, this was a stupid thing to base yourself on.
Right.
This hope that somehow the system could be made to be more democratic. And what we've seen, there's always been a tension in since the founding of the country between liberty and democracy and equality. That doesn't need to really be said.
Right.
But once the Soviet Union imploded, democracy got ever more hollow everywhere, there and here. It's been hollow for a very long time, and now it's like less than a shell. And as I don't want to keep going back to it, but given, the shenanigans that we're seeing in voter suppression and also in stripping people of any ability, even the way that Obama didn't fight back when they wouldn't hold hearings to give him a Supreme Court nomination.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's no fight from the Democrats. They're the go-along party. And I think Bob said it right. For Hillary Clinton, who really represents the neoliberalism in total. I mean, if you think of neoliberalism, you think of the Clintons. Right. So then for her to run against herself was always going to be a tall order. And so she was left with that tepid campaign where you were supposed to elect her because she deserved it, she was entitled, it was her turn, or she
Trump
was capable.
Was bad guy. I mean, she ran against Trump, but that was another thing, right? When you were talking about what she ran against. And what's interesting is Trump is a confrontational anti-status quo guy, right? So when he runs against Hillary, it fits within his narrative. It makes sense. And, Trump's genius is that every single bad thing about him fit within the narrative of his not being a political insider, not being politics as usual. Hillary wasn't that, right? I mean, she wanted to pretend to not be an insider, but no one really believed that. So her neck running against someone just didn't fit because she's supposed to be a positive. She's supposed to offer solutions.
And he always offered a solution, even if it was outlandish.
Yeah.
And he always had
that wall.
And he always had one message that he stuck to. So he was like always on brand. And he always had something positive and fantastical to tell you. And also something entertaining. Whereas every time she talked, Hillary was basically saying, slow down. I got this. Everything's fine.
Right. Or there's no, what do you mean everything's fine? There's nothing even, there's no problem.
There's a structural basis for this shyness about supporting any of these movements or pushing for any, smidgen of a decent social gains.
And to hear the rest of this interview, please subscribe on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And you'll get to hear the rest of the discussion, which is really cool. And we talk about how we can resist under Trump.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.